Well, I appreciate Glenn's invitation and Joe's hospitality, even if he added that little actually a member line, actually a member. I do want to bring greetings from all those churches where I've been preaching, and because we're all related, right? And also to bring greetings from the seminary where I teach, St. Paul School of Theology, and it's good to be with you this morning. I want to begin with a confession. Don't get your hopes up. It's not a juicy one, but my confession is simply this, that when I was in seminary, I took the two required church history courses and found it boring, totally boring, which is a real shame. I mean, if you weren't into history in general, you know what I mean. But even if you were, I thought, this is church history. This is the great history of God's dealings in the world and all that happened. And it just came out like a bunch of names and dates. And that is such the contrast with the book of Acts. Now, the book of Acts is not exactly a church history, but it's not a bad analogy. And it is anything but boring. It begins with that great story of Pentecost, thousands in Jerusalem for the festival, when the tongues of fire descend and speaking in other languages. That's a pretty good start to a history. And it ends with Paul on a ship sailing across the Mediterranean, going to Rome with the gospel, and in between all kinds of adventures. Even their business meetings are pretty good, because instead of talking about the budget or carpet, they're debating stuff like, now, who do you think can get into the faith? Can we let the Jews, the Gentiles, I mean, who gets in? It's anything but boring. Now, because the book of Acts is long, complicated, every once in a while, Luke, the author, will stop and give a little summary. Much the way a historian might at the end of a chapter or the beginning of a new section in a book. This passage that we read in Acts 2 is one of those early summaries. He's trying to sort of pull back and say, okay, let's think about what's happened so far. And he says they devoted themselves, all these early followers, to several things. The apostles' teaching, which of course were the teachings of Jesus that had come down. To fellowship, which doesn't mean a piece of pie in the church basement. It really meant shared life together. To the breaking of bread, which is always in Acts a reference to this meal, communion. That's Luke's phrase for it. And to the prayers. And then he goes on to say how they took care of each other, distributing their wealth. And then there's this one little line where I want us to focus our attention. They broke bread in their homes, or literally it says house to house, and they ate their food with glad and generous hearts. They broke bread, they ate food. That's a reference to two entirely different meals, but that had been woven together into one. So let me explain. For the last couple of years, I've been working on this book about early communion practices. So two Christmases ago on semester break, when all of our kids were home, adults now, they were, you know, doing whatever they were doing. They were watching movies, they were taking a nap, they were baking, and I was reading, I want to call them scholarly books, but my kids kept calling them nerdy books, about Greco-Roman banqueting. Because when the church was born and ate together, they didn't invent the way to eat. They ate the way everybody else in the Mediterranean world ate, and that was influenced by Greco-Roman banqueting. So every once in a while they were doing their thing and I was doing my thing, I would say, oh my gosh, listen to this. This is so cool. And they would put down their stuff and they would listen, and they were pretty convinced I'm a nerd. I plead innocent. Because, and I'll try not to bore you with too much of the details, but there's some fascinating stuff. Like, for instance, how many times have you heard this phrase, the upper room, as if that were just this one place, right? It was actually an apartment. Most everybody, except for the wealthy, lived in these apartments, 4 and 5 stories high, rooms that, it was only one room, 18 by 20, something like that. There'd be a couch on 3 sides of the walls. It would hold maybe 15 people. They would recline on their left side, they would eat, and it was a dinner, right? After dinner, they would have discussions. Over glasses of wine, they would have these long discussions. These evening meals lasted anywhere from 2.5 to 4 hours. And because it was a dinner party, afterwards, over wine, they would have discussions. And in the culture, these discussions might be philosophical, like, Which came first, the chicken or the egg? I'm not making this up. They actually debated that one. But when the church inherited this pattern, they thought, well, this discussion ought to be stories about Jesus. Now, fast forward a couple hundred years, and of course that becomes what I'm doing right now. One person doing the talking called sermon. The word means conversation. That's what it was originally. It was a conversation after dinner. But the most fascinating thing that I found, or at least one of, was how this meal and their ordinary meal were just part of one thing. In the most common pattern was that the first thing that happened when you arrived is somebody would break off a piece of bread and give it to you. It was the appetizer, it was the welcome, it was a way to fellowship. And then you would sit down to this meal, which would be, you know, figs and cucumbers and vegetables, maybe some meat, probably not. And then after that, there was this one cup of wine that was kind of more special than the others they would drink. Sometimes they poured it out, you know, like this cup that is poured out for you. Sometimes they drank from it. But it was all woven together. Now, there's a lot of things we don't know. There are gaps. But in the research that I've done, there are three things that we do know that totally stand out to me. And I have to warn you up front, not only are we 2,000 years removed, we are light years removed from how they did church and how they ate this meal. So here are the three things. The first was that it was always part of a full meal. There was no such thing as a little piece of bread and a thimbleful of grape juice. It was part of a full meal. And the point is not just how many calories were involved. It was the fact that over a full meal, there was intimacy. I mean, think about the dinner parties where for 2.5, 3 hours, you sit there and talk and you have a drink and that's how they got to know each other, sharing life together. The second thing was, it was mostly inclusive. You hear both words, mostly and inclusive. It was inclusive because they broke down barriers of gender and class and race that the society pretty much continued to have, but the church started breaking those down. They weren't perfect, therefore the mostly kind of thing, but they were moving a kind of countercultural thing, that this table would be open to all. And you think about in our day, lots of exceptions put on this meal as to who can eat it. And the third one was that it was always festive. It was always joyful and celebratory. The only exception was during Holy Week. During Holy Week, they remembered the suffering of Jesus, and so it was somber. But every other night of the week, and certainly on Sundays, the day of resurrection, it was joyful because, well, why not? Nobody ever signaled for the organist to play a minor key and they lowered the house lights because Jesus had been raised from the dead. He wasn't dead, he was alive. And he had promised that when he came back, he would eat with them. And so there was always a celebration. Now, I don't know which one of those three sort of stands out for you, but I've been thinking about the joyful one. You see, where Luke describes this early dinner party, Paul, you heard that reading, right? He seems to sort of snip out all the candles on the table and ruin the dinner party, right? I mean, you heard it. If you eat this thing wrong, you could die. That puts a damper on most dinner parties, right? Pick up the dessert fork. Oh, you're dead. But this is a complete misunderstanding of Paul. Paul has been misinterpreted for 2,000 years now. The only way I can explain it is to explain the two kinds of dinners they had. One was potluck, and it took place in those apartments, those upper rooms. And you know what potluck is, obviously. Everybody brought stuff. But the other type happened in the larger homes and really mansions. And they were patrons. The patron would say, I'll host the church. You don't have to bring anything. And so this person would host it. They still had these couches and large rooms. But here was the problem, and this is Paul's main concern. This is his only concern, actually. The wealthy, who were supplying the food, they didn't have to work. Or if they did, not much. And the poor, who were still laboring in the fields, they would get there later. And the rich were starting in on the appetizers, starting in on the food, starting in on the wine. And by the time the poor got there, there was no food. It wasn't that they were missing a little piece of bread and some juice. They weren't going to eat. Paul says you have to discern the body. He doesn't mean that when it gets time for communion, we should lower our head, close our eyes, think about what sins have we committed in our body. He's talking about the body of Christ. It's okay to have a festive dinner party as long as everybody is fed. Paul's concern is justice. He doesn't want to put out the candles. So for me, I've been thinking about this festive aspect. It doesn't come natural to us. Or maybe it does when we have dinner parties, but when we come in here, it doesn't, right? Because of, you know, our whole rearing. In some ways, I think what we've done is we've imported the austerity of Holy Week onto every Sunday. I think we've misread Paul, who's mostly concerned with the poor being fed. And we've also made it a time of personal quiet devotion, which is fine, but would have made no sense at a first century dinner party. So last summer, I was the preacher for the week for the disciples' musicians, right? All the disciples of Christ musicians from all over the country came. I was the preacher. Summer before that, I did a similar gig for the musicians of the American Baptist churches up in Green Lake, Wisconsin. And I remember because I told them, I knew what the schedule was. Every morning I preach, and I did a couple workshops during the day, but on Friday morning, that last worship service would be down by the lake, and it was a communion service. So I told the 30 or so musicians in one of my workshops that here is our mission, that when we get to that Friday, we're going to have a joyful communion. And I said, and you get to be a part of it because you're the musicians, and the music that gets played has a lot to do with the mood that's set and so forth. And we talked about all the details. And just by way of heads up, that's what we're going to do this morning, a joyful Eucharist. So we had a jazz quartet playing, and we told people, before you come and as you return to your seat, that's when you'll greet one another in fellowship and pass the peace, and we'll feast together. And I'm happy to report that down by that lake in Green Lake, Wisconsin, we pulled it off. It was festive. We were fellowshipping and hugging and talking. I mean, we'd all been at a conference all week. But I have to say, it was kind of like pulling teeth. You know, it just didn't come natural. There was something in us that said, I don't know. I mean, so I began with a confession, and I'll end with a confession, a historic confession of the church. Christ has died. Christ is risen. Christ will come again. Do you know that one? We live in between that second and third, after the resurrection of Jesus, but awaiting his return. And both of those are occasions of joy. He's not dead. He's been raised. This is not a funeral. And we are anticipating his coming again when he will feast with us at that big table in heaven. So let us enjoy the feast together this day. May it be so. Amen.